Good afternoon. I'm Mary Bathon with the Public Affairs Council. I'm here with Doug Pinkham, who is going to talk through the results of our annual pulse survey and discuss the findings and what it means to the outlook for your business. Right before we get started, I want to go over a quick logistical note. We do not open the phone lines live for questions. Instead, I would ask all of you to put your questions in the chat box that's on the lower left-hand side of your screen, and we'll go through those throughout the presentation. But I don't want to take away any of your time, so I'm going to pass it over to you, Doug.
Okay, thanks, Mary, and welcome, everyone. We will definitely allow time for questions at the end of my remarks, but if you have questions along the way, if you can type quickly and get them in, I'll make sure Mary nudges me and we go ahead and try to answer them that way too. So one way or another, we'll get all of your questions answered. So this is, as she said, this is about our new research project, the Public Affairs Pulse. We started this in 2011. We've been doing it every year since then. Here's the one quick slide on methodology. Our polling partner the last few years has been Morning Consult, which is one of the leading nonpartisan online polling companies. If anyone would like to have a longer conversation about telephone polling versus online polling, I have learned a lot in the last few years. We started out with a phone-based system, and we've now shifted to online. It's a survey of 2,202 adults conducted end of August with a margin of error of plus or minus 2%. There is the link to the full report, but the easy way, if you want to see the full report, is just go to our website at PAC.org, and under research, you'll find a direct link to anything and everything you want to know about the report, including you can get access to any of the charts and graphs I'll be showing if you want to use those in any internal presentations. That's available to members as well. So I thought it would be useful and interesting to do a quick headline of the most interesting finding from each of the surveys leading up to this year. Each of them were fairly substantial surveys. We started doing this, for those of you who don't know much about the Pulse project, we did this because there was a dearth of information about the public's views and expectations of big business and small business, especially as companies relate to society and to government. And because of that, we said, wow, what an opening to really do some exploration and in the process, create some value for our members in terms of insights, but also maybe help change the public dialogue a bit in terms of attitudes toward lobbying, towards big companies, and again, what views and expectations ought to be about business and society. 2011, I think the most interesting finding is that the overall favorability of major companies was quite high. When you compare it to small business, you never are going to compete with attitudes toward small business, which have been up around 92% some years. But for big business, it was actually up close to 70% the first year, and that honestly surprised us. And what surprised us most of all was that the age group that was most positive about major companies was young people, was millennials. And in further discussions with millennials on my staff, in my family, in the community, came to the realization that it's a very discriminating generation, and by that I mean, you look at companies for what value they bring you, and you don't necessarily have a prejudice against big business in the way that some older generations might have had when they were young and perhaps still do have. In 2012, we asked a series of questions. We asked certain ones every year, but then we add some new ones. In 2012, we started asking, when you give feedback to a company that's negative, what media do you use? Do you write letters? Do you make phone calls? If you have a complaint, do you post it online? If you've got something positive to say, how do you give that feedback? And what we found, at least back in 2012, is that if people had something negative to say, they were not that likely to actually post those comments online. They were more likely to actually write a letter. And part of that is that older people tended to, give negative feedback to companies than would younger people who would just move on with their lives. And as an older person now, I think I would validate that. I think that's actually the way things work. But I think since then, we have not asked that question. I think we might next year. I'm guessing that people are getting more comfortable for online feedback for a variety of purposes. 2013, one of the aha moments we had, which we still talk about each year and has picked up some media coverage, is that we were ranking companies by trustworthiness, and you'll see the updated data on that this afternoon. Well, in 2013, we also started rating them on a separate measure, and that was rating industries by whether they are overregulated, underregulated, or regulated the right amount. And what we discovered, and this was not a hypothesis, it was just something that was, you know, obvious as anything, that there's a real close correlation between the lack of trust in an industry and the public's perception that that industry is probably underregulated. There's not enough government oversight. And when you think about it, it makes sense because regulation is an act of distrust. If policymakers believe that your company and your competitors' companies in your industry are acting honorably and in the public's interest, and the public generally likes you, well, they've got more important things to do than to put new regulations on you that might not get approved because you're so darn popular. But if you're the kind of industry that's in the crosshairs, well, it might be politically advantageous for them to take you on. And if their constituents are complaining about you as well, because of your supposed lack of trustworthiness, it makes you subject to greater regulation. And the reason I think this is important, even though it might seem obvious, is, you know, it really shows the connection between communications and government affairs. That if you've got a strong reputation and you work as an industry to build a strong reputation, I do feel it insulates you to some degree from the threat of burdensome regulations. So it's a good argument for coordinating those functions. In 2014, we started really looking about social media and its impact. One of the questions we asked then and that we asked this year is, what has affected your attitudes toward small business and big business? And to our surprise, social media did not score very high in terms of its actual impact and having people form opinions. And I will make you wait a few more minutes to find out how this year we answered that question. So 2015, we started asking questions about lobbying. And as I will explain in a few minutes, lobbying is not a well-viewed profession, shall we say. And what we wondered is that if you use lobby as a verb and say, you know, we lobbied for this reason or we lobbied for that business reason, whether that would change public opinion. And what we found for the first time, and I think this is the first time anyone asked this question, is that if you state a business reason for lobbying, public opinion is actually pretty high. It's not even kind of average. It's actually above average. So we'll talk a little bit later about the implications of that finding because we continue to see it with each survey. In 2016, we started asking questions about involvement and engagement in social issues as that became a real thing in the corporate world. We did a separate membership survey, but we also asked questions in our poll survey about different forms of discrimination, are companies doing enough, and what are your expectations? And we found that public expectations are extremely high for companies to do more to end all forms of discrimination. And the sad news is that despite the fact that many companies have been doing a lot in many of these areas, like racial equality for decades, the public doesn't give you much credit for it. So what you are doing in that area may be viewed as table stakes. Like, of course you're doing that. We expect you to do it. And you may not get a lot of credit. So there's some interesting strategic implications from that finding. And then last year, it was very timely as there was some controversy over CEOs serving on President Trump's advisory committees, which is something the president always has on subjects like trade and labor, because some members were dropping off and it was controversial that they were on these committees. And what we found is that many Americans oppose CEO service on these advisory committees. And in many cases, they believe the reason CEOs serve on these committees is not to serve their country, but get this, to increase corporate profits. Right. And then about 9% said that CEOs did this to become more popular. And I would pretty much guarantee if any of your CEOs served on a presidential commission at some point, that just about all of them did it because they felt they had the opportunity to make a difference. And they thought that they were, you know, they had the unique expertise and wanted to do some public service. So it doesn't mean your CEO shouldn't serve on an advisory committee, but he or she should go into it with their eyes open and have a communication strategy associated with it. So that's some of the stuff we've done in the past. Here are the topics we addressed this year, and there's some pretty juicy stuff here, especially number one, and we've gotten a fair amount of media coverage of this. We looked at the president's tweets, who's reading them and why, And when he criticizes individuals and companies, whether it makes a difference. We looked at how people viewed different sources of political news for trust, including the news media, social media, political parties, friends and family, and others. Again, we looked at the favorability of large and small businesses. We had a series of questions related to foreign-based companies versus U.S.-based companies, because with the increase in sort of America First type attitude and controversies over trade, and talking to friends who work for companies that are headquartered outside the United States, they clearly are prepared for controversy should they be looking at a merger or an acquisition of a U.S. company, or if they push out a U.S. supplier by getting a contract of some size that might be viewed as costing American jobs. There is controversy, and the question is, will that get worse before it gets better? So we thought it was important to explore that subject. We looked at levels of trust in different industries, as we have in the past, and certain questions like favorability, trust in different industries, and regulation questions we ask every year, and so there's some good longitudinal data. If you ever want to see it, just let us know to look at how your industry has been rated over time. So we looked at what changes are in trust. We looked at trust in government, at regulatory trends and which industries are over-regulated and under-regulated, attitudes toward lobbying once again. And then we resurrected a question from 2013 where we asked people how elections should be financed. So let's get into the first couple questions, which relate to the president's tweets. And we had an inside bet on this, and I won, although I did not hit it on the nose. The question was, on our inside bet, is what percentage of respondents said they rarely or never read the president's tweets? And the way the question was worded is we said either you read it, you know, originally because you follow the president, or it's reported in the news media, which I would wager is the way most people hear about it. And I was saying 50%, and it wound up actually being 60% said they rarely or never read the president's tweets. As you can see by this chart, only 15% say they read it very often, 27% very often, so those two together is 42%, and then the rest is how you get to your 59 to 60%. So then you may ask yourself, well, why do his tweets draw so much attention? Well, I would say simply it's because a lot of Democrats are reading them and they tell their friends about it. Because if you look at the spread by political party, 46% of Democrats read the president's tweets either occasionally or regularly, and only 43% of Republicans read them, and only 36% of independents read the president's tweets even occasionally. So some of this is word of mouth, and in some cases I think it's media, frankly, getting all worked up over what the president says. I mean, there is news, but there's a certain point where I think it goes over the top. An interesting point I think to discuss here is often in the media they talk about the president's tweets as a perfect way for him to communicate with his base. Well, in looking at the demographics, and we have many, many crosstabs by age and gender and political affiliation and rural versus urban and so forth. That's one of the advantages of online polling is you don't have to ask those questions every time because you know the profiles of the people who are answering the questions. But if you say that, okay, a Trump base member is someone who would be someone who strongly approves of the president's performance, right? I mean, that's probably about the best way of defining it. But of those people, only one out of four, 25%, regularly read the president's tweets. So that's 15 on average, but even among his most loyal followers, it's only 25%. And when you look at certain other key demographic groups that are very important for the president, the scores are even lower. For example, evangelical Christians, who as a group are considered a strong component of his base, only 15%, so it's right at the national average. Among rural Americans, people who live outside the major cities, it's 14% read it regularly. And here's an interesting group, Republican women, which is increasingly important to the president because there's a lot of talk about a resurgence in women voting this election. Of Republican women, only 11% regularly read his tweets. So the other question, as I mentioned, is when the president says something bad about a company or someone, what happens? I think a lot of people assume that if the president said something bad about a company, a lot of people stopped using that company or, you know, sold its stock or said bad things about it. Well, what we found is that roughly 80% of the people out there who see the tweet, either it doesn't change their opinion, they don't know, they really have no opinion about it, or they just don't understand. And I made a point of putting in the option that they don't understand the president's criticism, because I'm of the belief that that's a significant number when he picks on an individual person or a company on something relatively obscure. You know, I follow this stuff, and sometimes I have no idea what he's talking about. And I think for a lot of average Americans, that's not an atypical reaction. So then you look at what's left. Well, it's not 20% think less of a company. 10% think less of a company, but get this, 10% actually like the company more. And you could probably identify, you know, it's your liberals, Democrats, and various other groups. It gets actually even more interesting when you look at how attitudes about individuals shift or don't shift when criticized by the president. I don't have a slide on that one, but I can tell you the numbers. It's a similar pattern, about 80% roughly, doesn't change their opinion, but 11% think less of that person when Trump criticizes them, and 12% think more. Again, there's a margin of error here, but it's interesting that actually more people would like a person more after the president has criticized them. And in fact, with certain demographic groups, I did some interesting research looking at the crosstabs, that if you wanted to become more popular with young people or minority groups, including African Americans, Hispanics, or Jewish Americans, it would be worth your while to basically tick off the president and get him to criticize you, because those are some of the groups who tend to like an individual quite a bit more when the president criticizes them. And then I thought, well, as part of a political strategy, if you're a Democratic candidate, you know, you're Beto O'Rourke or you're someone else who's a long shot, if you can somehow get on the president's radar and get him to criticize you, it should help you substantially with voters who care about health care, about women's issues, about education, and about energy issues. And so you're Beto and you're in Texas, and there's a lot of energy there. Half the population is women, and they've got education and healthcare challenges. So, you know, every time he gets criticized by Trump, which isn't often, and maybe Trump has shown some restraint on that, it probably actually helps him a little bit. So that's the reverse effect. Now let's get into the second, probably most newsworthy part of the poll, which is where do people go for political news? And we've put up lots of options, from your friends and family to the media to liberal and conservative groups to super PACs. And what you can see from this chart is if it's in red, that means people trust that source, either somewhat or a lot. If it's in orange, they don't trust it, either not very much or none. And if it's blue, they're just not sure. And there's a fair number who aren't sure. But as you can see, what the source that came in first is friends and family. And I think this replicates some findings. I know the Edelman Trust Barometer came out with some years ago of, you know, who do people trust for basic news and information, and it was friends or family. And I think things shifted from the news media to that group about 6 or 7 years ago. But this is for political news, an area people may not have a lot of expertise. And not only did friends and family win, but they won it going away. The news media came in second, but it was a pretty poor showing nonetheless, and that you expect the news media to be a source of news. It got 46%, but look at the number in the orange. 43% specifically said they don't trust the news media, and that's pretty terrible, that there's only a 3 percentage point difference between those who do trust and those who don't, and it's clearly not going in the right direction. One of the bigger surprises is in this entire study, and at the very end I'll be summarizing some of the big surprises, and I will tell you in advance this one showed up, is that look at the score for trade professional associations and businesses right behind the news media in terms of trust. You know, instead of 46, it's 45 and 44, but the level of distrust is actually quite a bit less than the news media. So this tells me that if you are running a PAC, if you have a grassroots program, if you're doing senior management briefings, if you're an association communicating to CEOs about political information, and if you're wondering whether people are trusting you as a source, they probably are. In fact, they're probably trusting you about as much as the news media. So those groups are on the ascendancy, and the news media is starting to drop. I personally don't think that's great for democracy, that the news media is down that much, but we'll just have to see what happens over time. One of the other points I want to point out to you is where social media is ranked, because often we act as if social media is the main source of political news for most people, and in fact it is, although we also know that the social media sites generally get their news from the mainstream news media to a large degree. But nonetheless, social media is way down the list. It's down at 31% for trust and 58% for distrust. I actually found this encouraging because it means that people have been reading the stories about Russian bots and about groups that, you know, peddling conspiracy theories, and I think they're becoming skeptical consumers of social media news. And, you know, I think at the end of the day, that's going to be one of the most important steps that we as a country can make to get the people to not believe everything they read on social media. So the fact that word's getting out for that is probably a good thing. Two last points I want to point out. One is, notice how conservative groups are rated better than liberal groups, 35% for conservatives, 30% for liberal. Yet Democrats are rated higher than Republicans, and that the Republican score for trustworthiness is similar to where conservatives are. In fact, it's exactly the same. You know, the fact that there's a spread between Democrats and liberals tells me that one of the real dangers the Democratic Party faces is that if it's viewed as lurching too far to the left with liberal candidates, that will certainly hurt it in general elections and in off-year elections, and certainly in the next presidential election. So I'm thinking the DNC probably realizes this, but there's some data to indicate how people view ideology sometimes different than the party itself. And at the very bottom, ironically, are the two forms of or sources of information that spend a lot of money, and that is political campaigns and super PACs, and they get the two lowest scores for trust. Now, having said that, that doesn't mean that people can't be influenced by TV ads, by candidates, or by super PACs. People often don't like to admit that they're influenced by advertising, but they're going into that relationship with the advertiser not being very trusting. So as those numbers decline, I think that will make it tougher over time for the candidates and for super PACs supporting them to have a lot of credibility. But it's interesting how low, in fact, those scores really are. So now let's look at how do Americans view business. I'll do this a little quicker because these are questions we ask each year. I should also note that before we get into questions of ethics, that overall favorability of major companies, unfortunately, has continued to decline. Overall favorability is now at 46%. You may remember at the beginning I said when we first started this survey it was up close to 70%. But even if compared to last year using the same methodology, the same polling company, major companies' favorability score was 52, and it dropped to 46, which is a sizable drop at a time, remember, of a healthy economy. Now, among Trump supporters, favorability is decent for corporate America. It's at about 55%, but among Trump opponents, it's now dropped down to 41%. And Mary and I were talking about beforehand is it's interesting when you look at support for the federal government, and I'll get to those numbers in a minute. When there's a Democrat in the White House and Democrats have at least half of Congress, Democrats are more likely to say the federal government's doing a good job. And then the day after Election Day and the Republicans take over, it's amazing how it flips and people suddenly change their mind, and now Republicans think that the federal government is doing a good job. But even now, those scores are not great. But there's a similar pattern since Republicans are viewed as the more business-friendly political party, that attitudes toward business seem to shift a bit with attitudes toward government. And this year I should note that even small business took a bit of a reputation hit. As I mentioned, it was up into the 90s percent favorability. Last year it was 87. This year it's down to 80. So there's just a certain cynicism about capitalism, I think, out there right now that we're going to have to monitor. I also want to just note that these numbers on ethics and honesty are interesting, especially at the bottom. Only 7% believe that big company CEOs have high levels of ethics and honesty. And notice how it goes up as you get to middle management employees, it goes up a little to 10%. And then non-management employees, it's at 17%. And so it's as if you get hired by a company and you're pretty trustworthy, but as you move up the chain, apparently your ethics go out the window, and finally you become a CEO and no one trusts you. And even small business owners only have a 35% rating for levels of public trust. So now let's look at how ideas are formed of Americans. I alluded to this earlier and how we had initially thought that social media would score well, and early on it did not. So we'll talk now about where it shows up. You can tell here that it does not show up in the top three. The major influencers on public attitudes toward business is the customer experience, and that's because people like their smartphones, they like their big screen TVs, they like their cars and the cool stuff that you get from big companies. And they pay attention to that, and that's one reason that the companies are rated as well as they are. They get a certain amount from the news. Based on a survey question we asked last year, they're more likely to find the news giving negative information about big companies more than positive information. And then just generally from the internet, that's at 57%. But if you go down the list a while, you get to social media. And only 43% say that social media, such as Facebook and Instagram and Twitter, affect their opinion of companies. Again, that continues to surprise me because I think a lot of folks figure that, you know, the way companies are often talked about on social media, that it would influence the average person's opinion. Well, that is true for younger people. Gen Z, which, by the way, if you're not paying attention, that's the newest group, which is ages, at this point, ages 18 to 21, 55% of Gen Z say that social media has an impact on their opinions of companies, and 53% of millennials agree with that. I mentioned that you know, we've also asked questions about what the biggest successes and failures of companies are. The biggest success is the stuff you buy. You know, people think that companies provide good services, and that's, for those who like big companies, that's generally the reason why. The biggest failure, the thing that people are most cynical about, may surprise some of you, but it continues to be executive pay. Issues around not only how much the CEO gets paid, but overall fairness in compensation throughout an organization. That is considered a failure. And I should also note that the demographic group who is most ticked off about this is not necessarily young people or the folks you would imagine who don't have a lot of money. The group that is most upset about executive comp tend to be older people who are more educated and more highly compensated themselves. I'm guessing, meaning they make over $100,000 a year. I'm guessing that a lot of those folks figure, I work hard, I'm making $150,000. What's this damn CEO doing who failed walking away with a severance package of $3 million? So, again, not a lot you can do about it in your jobs, but it's an area you need to be aware of that will be controversial with your employees as well as with the general public. So questions about foreign firms. First time we've asked this, we found that a generic company headquartered in the U.S., if you don't know anything more about it, gets a good score, kind of like what everyone used to get. It's 71%. If they are outside the U.S., the generic foreign firm, and we don't say anything about jobs or products, 29%, which is a very low favorability. Again, we haven't asked this question before. It'll be interesting to see in future years if the spread is as big. Those two data points are evidence that there is a really strong sort of made in America movement, and people are willing to act on it politically as well as in their buying. So then we threw in some variables. We said, well, what if this foreign-based company provides many American jobs? Well, it jumps up, the favorability jumps up to 57, which is pretty strong. So if you're a foreign-based company, you know, it's jobs, jobs, jobs. You've got to be telling that story. There are a lot of firms who do it very well. I will say particularly a shout out to Honda, Toyota, and other foreign automobile manufacturers, and we actually have materials some of those companies and others have shared of how they talk about jobs and some of the interesting infographics they use. Then we said, well, what about a firm that just makes a lot of great stuff, you know, and they may not have a lot of American jobs, but we all use their phones, we use their other products. That won't get you much. It'll get you up to 38% favorability. So unless you're providing a lot of American jobs, I don't believe there is a lot of, you know, consumer capital to be had or political capital associated with being a big foreign firm. Next, we go to issues of trust, both industry in general as well as individual sectors. In general, I will tell you that the confidence of the ethics of major companies has continued to decline, as well as favorability. Only 42%, that's if you add up the totals from a lot and some on the chart, only 42% have some confidence in companies to behave ethically. This 42% is down substantially. It was 47% last year. I think with each, you know, corporate scandal or controversy involving companies, it can drop just a little bit. I should also point out that 5 years ago in 2013, that number was all the way up to 54% believe that big companies have a certain amount of ethics. So that's a real concern. When you break it down by political party, there are some vast differences. Republicans, as I said, tend to be more pro-business. 50%, which is still not a huge number, have some confidence in the ethics of big companies. Democrats at 45%. But honestly, folks, the group you really need to worry about in a whole host of areas is independents, because they're down at 35% for trust in the ethics of major companies. This is a group who's cynical about government, but they are also cynical about business. Let's look at individual companies and sectors, because this is the slide everybody wants to hear. I'm sure there's some pharmaceutical companies in the audience, and my condolences. You don't want to be at the top of this list. What we've done is we've ranked them by the sectors that had the highest scores for being untrustworthy when compared to other sectors. Other polling firms have done studies where they say, are drug companies trustworthy, yes or no? And we're of the view that doesn't really teach you much. You want to know how you view pharmaceuticals versus other industries, because otherwise people who don't trust any companies will just say no to everything. So for like the third year in a row, I believe, pharmaceuticals outpaced health insurance to be the least trustworthy. You want to be at the bottom of this list, and you'll note that manufacturing companies, I would say especially U.S.-based manufacturing companies, do the best because their score for being untrustworthy was 18%, and this is not shown on this chart, but it's in the study. Their score for being trustworthy was 22%. The rest are people who said that they're as trustworthy as everyone else or they really had no opinion. Food and beverage companies actually improved. Only 19% said they were less trustworthy than average, and 24% said they are more trustworthy. As I said, pharmaceuticals did not do well. They've been at or near the bottom since we began this survey. And this year, I will tell you, if you are a drug company, that the percentage saying you are untrustworthy rose from 51% to 55%, and the percentage rating you as trustworthy fell from 13% to 11%. And finally, look where the tech industry is. It's not a bad score, but you have to remember that for the first 5 or 6 years of this study, it always came in first place for trustworthiness by a long shot. And now it's in the middle of the pack. And in fact, it got only sort of a middling score for companies who found it actually trustworthy. But at this point, it's not bad, but its trajectory is not positive. And when we get to the slide on regulation, I think you'll find it even more alarming for tech companies. So I've already alluded to this, so I won't go into detail. I will tell you that overall favorability of the federal government, this slide shows the differences between political parties, because once again, I was showing you the stark differences between Republicans, Democrats, and independents, 44% versus 33 versus 26. I will tell you that in terms of overall favorability, on average, it's right where Democrats are. Only one out of three Americans, 33%, have a favorable view of the federal government. That's down from 36% last year. Once again, the defenders of the federal government tend to be Republicans. But even again there are more Republicans who have a negative view than positive view. For those of you who work in state government relations, it used to be a bright spot if you worked in state government, and I think because they did way better historically than the federal government in terms of public opinion, I think because people feel closer to their state government because they provide real services and they might even know their state legislators. But those numbers are dropping. Last year, favorability of state government was at 49%. Now it's at 46%. And incidentally, the area of the country with the lowest support for state government is the Midwest, where favorability is only 40%. Another slide on how Americans view government. Again, here we're showing it by political affiliation. You can see that this question is different. It's not favorability, it's do you have confidence in the federal government to solve problems? And the scores are almost identical to what you saw, which is basically means that public view favorably a government that solves big problems. It's not just getting out your Social Security checks and providing services as they expect government to be a problem solver, and only one out of three have confidence in the federal government to do just that. Again, there's lots of cynicism and despair among independents. Also, I should note that elected officials in D.C. Scored actually even worse than CEOs, when it comes to having a reputation for ethical behavior. You remember CEOs got a score of 7%, viewed the ethics of CEOs being high, and only 6% said this about federally elected officials. Now let's get on to regulation. Generally, we try to ask questions that no one else has asked, and we've been successful at doing that. But once in a while, we make an exception, and this is one. The Pew Research Center, which I have tremendous respect for, they do very thorough, very nonpartisan, rigorous research on all kinds of emerging issues, and I encourage you to check out their stuff regularly. And it's stuff you can rely on, really rock-solid methodology. But one of the questions they say, and we have copied it, I will admit, is you have two choices, and you got to pick one if you can, although you're allowed to say, you know, you can't make up your mind. You try to get them to pick one. Is regulation necessary to protect public interest, or does regulation of business typically do more harm than good? So this is really an ideological choice. Are you just inclined to say we need regulation of some level, or you basically say, you know what, most regulation is a waste of time and effort and hurts the economy? Over the years, these numbers have tracked very closely together. In fact, historically, it's been one-third of the public believes regulation is important, one-third says it isn't, and the rest aren't sure or say it's that these two things cancel each other out. But once in a while, you see one opinion starting to outmaneuver the other. And I have found over time, and one of these days I need to write like a scholarly paper on this subject, that when opinion shifts toward regulation being more harmful than good, it starts to show a coming wave of conservatism in America. And when public opinion starts to shift toward regulation is more necessary than unnecessary, it starts to show a wave of the rise of Democrats and a more progressive liberal view of the country. That was true in the 90s with the Gingrich Revolution. Attitudes toward regulation were already starting to increase, in terms of negative attitudes even before Gingrich became Speaker of the House, but certainly it accelerated for a number of years after that. Some years later, it waned in the other direction. When Obama was elected, interest in regulation as a protector of the public interest increased. It started to wane toward the latter part of his term, but of late it is picking up. So look in orange up on the screen, which is 2017, and you can see there's a slight edge for those who believe that regulation is necessary to protect the public interest, 29 to 27. Now look at the spread this year. The percentage who feel that regulation is necessary has jumped to 31, and more alarmingly, I guess, for those who are against burdensome regulation, the percentage who say that regulation does more harm than good has dropped to 23%. I am not making election forecasts. This would tell me that the environment is more friendly to Democrats now than it was even last year. So that's something to be aware of. So let's go into who needs more oversight. This is the companion chart. If you look closely at that last chart, some four charts ago, about trustworthiness, you will see that very close correlation between whether an industry is considered untrustworthy and whether it is considered underregulated. So once again, in the lead, as terms of companies who are not in a good position, is pharmaceutical companies based on public opinion are most in need of more regulation. I'm sure that's not a welcome thought. Followed by health insurance, banks, energy, and look at technology, slightly above average there. It used to be at the bottom of the list as recently as 2 years ago. The companies or the sectors that are doing quite well are manufacturing, where 21% say there is too much regulation and only 19% believe there is too little regulation. In fact, that is the only sector in which people say that regulation is too strict. And every other one, even if the overall score is low on this list, the percentage of people who said, you know, regulation was too high was even lower. So it doesn't mean that if you score at the bottom of this list that people want to deregulate your industry. It just means they think that what you have now is the proper amount of regulation. And again, look at the tech industry, and that is a chart that basically proves the increasing regulatory risk they face. So as we enter the home stretch, a couple slides left, let's look at lobbying. As I mentioned, we've asked this question a number of years now, and we have validated this question over 5 years with three different polling firms, three different samples. So I'm pretty confident in the results. We give specific reasons why a company would lobby, and we ask these 2,202 respondents to say whether this is an acceptable form of corporate lobbying. As you can see, if you're protecting jobs, people have no problem with that. 56% give that a favorable score. Only 18% give it a negative score. If you're supporting social causes, which has clearly become a thing in the corporate world, and we've done a number of programs and articles about that, 51% positive, 21% negative. If you're creating a level playing field with competitors here and around the world, some of you may wonder whether that would be supported by the public because it's designed to increase profitability, and overwhelmingly people are fine with that. And even the ones that are below 50% still have a plurality. They have more people believe that's an acceptable form of lobbying than otherwise. So at the bottom of the list, if you're trying to secure government funding or grants, which to some people would sound selfish, 38% say it's good, and only 32% say it's not. So my advice to all of you is whenever you talk about lobbying, talk about why you're lobbying, for what business purpose, especially to your employees, but to the general public as well. I know of companies who say, we have this lobbying office in Washington. You know, let's not do that. I know a number of companies who say we have a business office in Washington where they represent the company's interests before government, or they defend the company's business interests to be profitable and provide good jobs. It's worth putting it in context if you're trying to win support internally or externally. And the last question, and then I'll do a quick summary and we'll get to your questions, is campaign finance. And this was really interesting. People have no problem with rich people running for office and spending their own damn money. This is, again, one of those sort of media myths that people don't like rich people. A lot of people actually admire rich people, and they don't have a problem with them running for office. They'd like to have their money spent. So that's the most popular method for financing elections of all kinds, followed by individual contributions, followed by PACs. Those of you in the PAC area should be pleased to see those numbers, followed by super PACs, and in last place, which is interesting given this is the goal of a lot of good government organizations, is public financing of campaigns by using federal tax dollars. Again, we asked this question 5 years ago with a telephone-based polling system with an entirely different polling firm and received almost identical results in exactly the same order. I should also tell you that this is one of the few questions one could ever find where Republicans and Democrats not only agree, but their scores are almost identical in terms of percentages of the top three. You know, number one is candidates spending their money, number two is individual contributions, and number three is PACs. And in fact, among people who call themselves Republicans, 57% approve of PACs, and of those who call themselves Democrats, 56% approve of the use of PACs. Now, that is one interesting finding, given you, I'm sure you've seen the news, that upwards of 185 Democrats running for office for next week have said they are refusing to accept corporate PAC contributions out of principle because they view it as tainted money, even though that more than half of Democrats approve of that. The Atlantic, I should say, did a really good article on this very subject actually before our survey came out. And basically they said, you know, this is a symbolic protest because, as many of you know, most PACs don't give to non-incumbents. You tend to support people who already agree with you, and a number of these candidates were not exactly pro-business, and they probably weren't going to get a contribution anyway. But a member of the media at a conference I attended recently said that this is a precursor to widespread public opposition to PACs, and I took great pleasure in reading him our data, which had not even come out yet, to say that that actually is an incorrect point of view. So, quick highlights here. Here's my David Letterman top 10 list. Normally when I do this, I show these one at a time with some background music, but hey, we don't have animation today. So number 10 is, this is the 10 most interesting things I found. You may disagree, but I think it's a good way to do a summary. Number one is that, once again, only one out of three Americans like the federal government. Two is that the favorability and trust of big companies continues to fall. I would worry when we get into a recession and people, including our president and others, are going to look for whose fault it is, that big companies are going to get a lot of the blame. Because if people are upset with you during good times, then to be blunt, you're going to get thrown under the bus during bad times. Number eight, most people agree that public financing of elections is a bad idea. Number seven, in terms of trustworthiness as a political source, media, business, and associations are all at the same level in a virtual tie for second behind friends and family. Number six is that tech firms are experiencing what I would call a fall from grace and face increasing regulatory risk. Number five, Republicans and Democrats agree on how to fund campaigns, and it's hard to find anything they agree on. Number four, the Democrats are more likely than Republicans or independents to read tweets from POTUS. Number three, that fewer than one out of three Americans trust social media for political news, which is one bit of encouraging, I think, news in this study. Number two is that public support for regulation seems to be increasing based on history. And number one is that if you're a company criticized by Trump in one of his tweets, for the love of God, don't overreact. I do not blame the early companies like Lockheed, Boeing, and others, especially them who for whom government is their major customer, that it was panic time because this had never happened before. I thought they handled it pretty well. But since then, as the president has criticized Amazon like four or five times, they just don't respond at all, even though they are a government contractor, but they have a lot of other non-government business. Harley-Davidson was criticized, certainly CNN many times and other media companies, Nordstrom, and the list goes on. But at this point, I think you've probably gotten the message that just out of sheer quantity, not everyone takes everything the president says seriously on Twitter. So with that, do we have some questions?
We do, yes. We do have a lot of time left over for questions, so please put those in the chat box right now. We do have some already. So it seems that trust is down across the board. Which group would you say has the best chance to rebound first? Would that be large companies, federal or state governments?
I would put my money on state government. You know, it's going to be interesting to see what happens next week with elections and who becomes the governor, what happens with state legislatures during times of change, you know, and then, in fact, these are some really competitive races that tends to make government more attuned to the public and to voters. So it's conceivable you might see some improvement. But I also got to say that during bad economic times, if we do face a recession in the next few years, no one does well and no one improves their scores. But I think that's probably the area with the greatest potential improvement.
Mm-hmm. Now, associations and businesses are rated highly as far as people trusting them for mm-hmm. political news. How could they either leverage that point or really use that to their advantage?
Yeah, I think that's one of the real interesting findings is how well associations do. I've worked for associations my whole career. That was never my intent, but it's been a really interesting profession for me. And one of the challenges we often faced in organizations where I've worked is, you know, you can be taken seriously by the trade press because you're an authoritative voice. A lot of people in the mainstream media might find you suspect because you're representing an industry or a cause. Sometimes the general public don't know who you are or, you know, they just look at you as a special interest. But I would give some of the same advice to trade associations that I give to companies. You know, that if I used to work for the American Gas Association, and, you know, one of the advantages of natural gas is that of the fossil fuels, it was the cleanest. And we would use that in a lot of our advertising and our communications outreach. I think when you tie what you're doing to say we're representing the business interests of this industry, which creates jobs, making that connection in the same way a company would, if there are social causes you support as a group, that's worth mentioning. If you're leveling the playing field with companies from around the world, that's certainly worth mentioning. But, you know, if you have a public benefit, which in the natural gas industry you could say that we did positive things for the environment, that's another, you know, way of explaining what you do. And it's a way of not being viewed as a selfish special interest. So I think there's some real opportunities for associations and professional societies.
Mm-hmm. Shifting towards the tech industry, you know, Facebook's running this big commercial campaign right now to, you know, kind of apologize and get trust back. Do you think the tech industry as a whole will continue to slide, or do you see them recovering?
I think one of these days we may have to break out that category because at this point, well, first off, for a while when, you know, everybody wanted to be a tech company, you know, you made chemicals, you say, well, we're really a tech company because we're using technology. Yes, we make medical devices, but we're really a tech company. And there's truth to that because everybody is kind of a tech company. Now some of them are going to say, well, we're actually not really a tech company, we're a medical device company. But we rate, you know, we rank, we put telecoms in with technology, and, you know, for logical reasons, and many others as well. I think the social media companies are going to take the biggest hit for obvious reasons that you mentioned, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram and others. And I think that situation is going to get really dicey. And, you know, there's advantages and disadvantages of being in a line of work that public policymakers don't understand, because sometimes if they don't understand you, they don't regulate you. But if they do regulate you, you're really in trouble, because that's where you get unintended consequences, and they could basically take your business plan and say it's now legal and you're out of business. Mm-hmm. So there's that challenge, and it's not a coincidence that many tech companies are staffing up in government relations and getting more sophisticated. Microsoft certainly set the stage for that back in the 90s when it faced some real controversy from the Justice Department, State Attorneys General, and they went from a very small department to a very large one now and a very effective one. So, but I think you almost have to look at it piece by piece. But I'd say if you are a small company, I would be worried, because, and I would probably find some way of getting in the game and being engaged in public policy at multiple levels, at a minimum through a trade association, and next step with a contract lobbyist, and at some point, if you're of any scale, looking at some in-house help. Because it is true, the old adage that if you don't have a seat at the table, you're probably on the menu, because mm-hmm. We're at a time when there's not a lot of extra money, and when one industry benefits, another loses. And the debate over tariffs is a perfect example of that. Steel users are quite upset. Some steel manufacturers are pleased. Some aren't, depending on, you know, how they work. If you're not engaged in it and monitoring what may happen, unintended consequences occur. So I think that you're going to see a lot of political involvement by many tech companies that haven't been involved in the past.
Mm-hmm. Why are some of Trump's biggest supporters not paying attention to his tweets?
Well, you know, not everyone lives in Washington and follows politics every day. I know that's a shock to many of you out there. My wife is one of them, and God bless her for that, because otherwise we'd make each other absolutely nuts. She makes me put down my phone. But, you know, a lot of people are working long hours in a job. They have sick parents. They are a single parent taking care of their kids. They probably have some level of internet access, but maybe they don't have a good signal. I mean, there's a million reasons, but I think it's a question of time and priorities and interest. People who are loud tend to have a disproportionate impact, right? And one of the things about information technology and the internet is that it has allowed many more people to be loud. And so sometimes you can create the impression of a movement and of a groundswell of support that may or may not be there. So I'm not saying that his support is shallow. I actually think that Trump's base is a pretty healthy size. It's often been estimated at somewhere 20 to 30% of the population. Some years ago, I read that, you know, like 23% of the population listened to Rush Limbaugh, and that seems about right. It's probably a similar group, not identical, of the people who percentage who follow Trump. It might be even a little higher. But it's not a majority. But interestingly, even among that group, there are folks who don't catch what Trump's saying on Twitter, and maybe because Rush Limbaugh's mentioned it.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, I think that's all the questions that we've gotten, but thank you for that great overview. And as Doug mentioned, you can go online, view all the crosstabs of data, and obviously reach out to us if you want us to dig into a specific industry or crosstabs generational-wise. Happy to do that as well. Thank you all for joining us today. There will be a feedback form that pops up after you close out of the webinar. Please fill it out. Let us know if there's some programming areas you'd like us to put on the calendar for 2019, especially after reading through these results. So with that, have a great afternoon and beginning to your week.
Thank you so much.